Hello and welcome to the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. One of my first guests was Geoffrey Cox. We discussed in length the Java Sea campaign in episode 14. Well, Geoffrey has had his head down and has been busy penning his follow-up book, Morning Star, Midnight Sun, which looks at the early Guadalcanal Solomons campaign in 1942. And that's what we're going to be discussing in this episode. But before we get started, I'd like to thank Michael Samuels. Not only has he become a patron of the show, but he sent me some interesting documents in regards to the Buchenwald Airmen episode. If you have anything you'd like to share, you can shoot me an email using the contact page in the website, www.podcast.com, or find me on Facebook. If the owner consents, I may have some pictures of the castle featured in Castle of Eagles, where the British prisoners of war were held in Italy. All good stuff. Don't forget, if you like what I'm doing, you can help support the show at patreon.com/ww2podcast. Once a patron, you'll find some extra bits and pieces I've produced exclusively for supporters of the show. So that's patreon.com/ww2podcast. Right, Geoff, it's great to have you back. A simple question first. I suspect most people can't put a pin in the map where the Solomon Islands are. So where are they?
They are in the South Pacific. They are sort of northeast of Australia across the Coral Sea.
So what's the importance of Guadalcanal for the Japanese to occupy them in 42?
What the Japanese were doing at this point was they had a strategy of trying to isolate Australia. That strategy was kind of sidelined by the Midway operation for the Navy. The Army was always proceeding to isolate Australia by crossing New Guinea, Papua, and taking Port Moresby so that Australia could be compelled to leave the war. But protecting the sea lanes and the air lanes to Australia was one of the precepts of the Arcadia Declaration. The Japanese wanted to cut off Australia so it would not be a jumping off point for a counteroffensive. The Army and the Navy, they could not agree on really anything. There was Imperial General Headquarters where the Army and the Navy were sort of coordinated, but they weren't really ordered necessarily. And they sort of each did their own thing. They're only dimly aware of what the other was doing. The Army would try to take New Guinea. The Navy had a different idea. They were going to build a network of island bases proceeding down the Solomons and then going to the New Hebrides, Fiji, New Caledonia. And by this network of island air bases, they were going to cut off Australia.
Presumably these bases are acting almost like carriers, you know, that insofar as you've got, you know, bases you can land, you don't have to put carriers to sea, they can't be sunk. In that respect, that's what they're allowing to do. Project air power.
This was the Japanese plan. It was originally called FS. And then Midway came, so FS was shelved. After Midway, they dusted off the FS plan, and then they shelved it again. But they needed to build up more defenses for the Pacific Island Empire. And building up those defenses looked suspiciously like the FS operation going down that chain of islands in the South Pacific. And so one of them discovered that they had a seaplane base at Tulagi that they occupied during the Coral Sea Battle. And they said, hey, there's this place just south of Tulagi called Guadalcanal, and it's got a place near Lunga that make a very nice air base. So they studied a little bit, and then they sent out some construction crews down there, guarded by these special naval landing force troops. And they used hand tools to build the airbase. They had like bulldozers and stuff there, but they didn't use them. And they used some native labor. They had a good working arrangement with the natives. They offered, you come work for us, and in exchange, we will not kill you. And some of the natives thought that was a very fair exchange, and so they went and worked. There are other claims that the Japanese just offered them lots of rice. I've seen both. But the natives were working on this airfield to help extend that Japanese line to cut off Australia down the Solomons. And at that same time, Admiral King was trying to seize on the initiative that was given by the Battle of Midway. The Japanese had still not recovered from it. We need to strike, and strike now.
You make the comment in a book that they're trying not to do something rash for the sake of doing something with Reed King and Nimitz in this instance. Sorry, I didn't make a bit interrupt you there, but I thought it was an interesting point to bring in as you're talking about, you know, King's view of Guadalcanal. I think it was a really good statement.
Part of it was changing a mindset. You know, we had been attacked. We had been beaten back for 6 months. During that entire time, King was looking first for legalistics through the Arcadia Declaration. Also, you know, through actions, like even just counterattacking near Rabaul, where we sank some Japanese transports off of New Guinea, looking at places to counterattack to at least take a swipe with a knife here, take a swipe with a knife there, until we can really hit him with a sword and until we have that power. He didn't want us to just keep taking a pounding. He wanted to change the mindset, and he was always looking for a place to strike. This got into a fight, a bureaucratic fight in the South Pacific, because the U.S. Army had Douglas MacArthur, and the U.S. Army wanted Douglas MacArthur to head any counteroffensive in the Pacific. But King kept looking for places to carry out this offensive, and places where you could use as stepping stones, that's something else in the Arcadia Declaration, to go up and start chipping away at the Japanese Empire, or the greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere, which the South Pacific was neither in Asia nor was it prosperous. And they found Tulagi and Nadini in the Santa Cruz Islands, and Tulagi in the Solomons, and King said, okay, you're gonna start taking these islands. We're going to have an amphibious operation, and we're going to do it about August 1st. And the Navy commander in the South Pacific, Admiral Gormley, is like, no, we're not. We're not going to be ready for it. That didn't go over well with Admiral King. Admiral Gormley was not the person really to be running the campaign for various reasons. But the campaign, the offensive, and this is where it was different from other offensives in history. An offensive is normally where you take the initiative. You decide where and when to attack and with what. That's taking the initiative to the enemy. We didn't quite do that here. It was the Japanese who determined precisely where and when we were going to attack. We took the offensive by attacking, but it wasn't necessarily the initiative. The Japanese, by starting the airfield on Guadalcanal, they were going to complete it in early August. And so we had to invade in early August. Otherwise, they were going to bring the airfield online. They're going to have it defended. They're going to have aircraft there. They're going to have troops there. And it was going to be much more complicated and much more expensive in terms of lives and materiel to get them out. So we had to attack right then. We weren't quite ready for it. We didn't have quite the logistics assembled for it. There were still command fights in the South Pacific, which manifested themselves at the infamous pre-invasion conference at Coro, which ended up as a shouting match, apparently. But the invasion came off relatively without much of a hitch, strangely enough, until Admiral Mikawa and the Japanese cruisers showed up at Savo Island and destroyed everything.
Just before we get there, which I was going to say, that it was interesting. What I found interesting was the big discussion with Turner and Fletcher over how long to keep the carriers in the area. So you've got the Navy disagreeing with itself over, you know, just before the invasion goes in, or the landings go in, that, you know, Turner wants 5 days and Fletcher wants 48 hours. I mean, that's a really big difference when you're putting boots on the ground.
Yes, it is. And Admiral Fletcher, he was sort of caught in the middle here, and he should not have been caught in the middle. Admiral Gormley was really the commander of the South Pacific. His purview was not clear in terms of what he was supposed to do in the South Pacific. Was he supposed to be hands-off with his commanders and just coordinate? Was he supposed to lead? Admiral King thought he was supposed to be at the front. The problem was that Gormley did not think we should be doing this offensive, and he joined in with MacArthur, which was another problem he had, and condemned it in a letter. That didn't go over well with people. And then when they're having this pre-invasion conference at Coro, Gormley didn't even show up. And so one interpretation is that he said, well, okay, you don't take my advice, I'm washing my hands of it. You know, there's something in sports. I mean, we have it here in American football, playing not to lose, playing very conservatively, you know, trying to score necessarily, just taking advantage of what little opportunities are, but not pushing the issue. Gormley played as if we had already lost. He was trying to preserve as many assets as he could for after we lost, and he had to stop the Japanese elsewhere. He did not play to win. Admiral Fletcher played not to lose. Because Gormley had abdicated his responsibilities, it was left to Admiral Fletcher. He commanded the operation, but he had conflicting orders. He was to support this invasion with his carriers, but Admiral Nimitz had told him that you're to exercise calculated risk. You are not to risk your carriers to damage unless you can inflict equal or more damage to the enemy. And those orders had been given just before the Battle of Midway. They had not been rescinded. And so Fletcher was being asked to risk his carriers for this invasion, while Admiral Nimitz was telling him, you can't risk your carriers unless you can inflict like or greater damage on the enemy.
They're still a formidable force, aren't they? I mean, this is post-Midway. It's not as if Midway was something that knocked the Japanese Navy out of the battle. They're still a very formidable force the Japanese have in the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah. They outnumber us. They have quantity. They have quality for the most part. They lost four carriers and a cruiser at Midway. And that was their biggest defeat by far, but that was it. They still had more carriers in the Pacific than we did, including the very new Shokoku and Zuikaku. They had more battleships, and they had many more cruisers. But yeah, the Japanese were still superior. Admiral Fletcher knew that, and he was asked to put his carriers in a defensive position. They had to stay in this in a limited area in order to defend these landing craft, in order to defend the supplies, in order to defend the transports. Well, if you put your carriers in one area and you keep them there, eventually they're going to be found. And then what do? Your carriers are vulnerable. They could be sunk, as we would discover later on. That was Fletcher's point. The problem was that he had a responsibility to the operation to ensure that the operation succeeded. He placed the operation second to the survival of his carriers, and he did not consider whether the damage inflicted by the carriers in this case was equal along different lines to anything the Japanese could do to the U.S. Because if we're taking a base in the South Pacific, that damages the Japanese. Is that equal to the loss of a carrier? I don't know, but it's along different dimensions. And Fletcher never resolved that conflict in his orders, and he didn't seem to have even made an attempt to resolve it. He didn't have confidence in the operation. He thought it was going to fail. He was going to do the minimum necessary to support it. He had some valid complaints, but he had a responsibility to the operation, and he seemed to just be very cavalier about it in terms of, you know, I'm going to leave after 48 hours. He even left early. That's what set in motion the string of dominoes that led to the defeat at Savile Island. He could not have foreseen that his decision would cause Turner to call a conference that would lead his Admiral Crutchley away from his ships at the time when the Japanese were going to attack. I mean, Fletcher could not have predicted that. No one could have predicted that.
Run us through Savile Island, because it is I don't know if you would call it a disaster, but it's certainly a cock up for the Allies and a huge triumph for the Japanese.
Yeah, mitigated on both sides. It was the worst defeat in U.S. Navy history. Savile Island had so many screw-ups on so many levels for the Allies, and so many things had to go right for the Japanese. There was a lot of luck involved. There's always a lot of luck involved in war. You had a scout plane, an Australian scout plane. It discovered Mikawa's cruisers, but it misidentified them. It was a good faith misidentification, but it misidentified them as seaplane tenders. That got the Allies thinking something different was going on. Its report was delayed by something within MacArthur's command. There were a lot of reports that were delayed throughout the war by inefficient communications. And this was among the worst of it because it was among the most disastrous. But its report was delayed, and it wasn't the Australian pilots' fault, as you know, Morrison blamed them, but it was not their fault. It was something within the communications line. That report didn't get in time for it to be necessarily useful. Admiral Turner had asked for an additional scout plane to be sent up the slot. And so he had asked the land-based air commander, Admiral McCain, who is the grandfather of the senator, U.S. Senator John McCain. So it got screwed up so badly that the land-based air ended up searching everywhere except the most likely avenue of Japanese approach, which was through the slot. The aircraft was not sent up for some reason that remains disputed, and Turner was not told that it was not set up. He didn't hear anything, so he assumed that they hadn't found anything. He calls a conference because of Fletcher informing him that he's going to pull out. Turner wants to talk to his commanders. He's probably made a decision already that he has to pull out as well, but he wants to talk to his commanders. Turner calls Admiral Crutchley on the radio and says, I need you to meet with me at such and such a time. Crutchley tells his second in command in his force. He's divided his force up into two parts to handle either side of Savo Island. Savo Island created a tactical dilemma because it created two avenues of approach and you had to guard both of them. So he told the second in command of his southern force where he was, Captain Bodie, that he was going to leave and that Bodie would be in charge of the force. He didn't tell his actual second in command of this force, Captain Reeve Cole, who was in the northern force, the other force, because Royal Navy protocol assumed that Reeve Cole would have gotten the order that Crutchley was to go to this conference and thus he'd be away for a while. Unfortunately, that meant Reeve Cole didn't know he was in charge, and then Captain Bodie didn't know who was in charge because ultimately he didn't know when or if Crutchley was going to come back. And then Crutchley goes in to this meeting, and you have these ships guarding the transports on the warships on either side of Savo Island, and they don't know who's in charge. They don't know that the Japanese are coming. And then you have the last line of defense, which are two picket destroyers out in the slot. The Blue and the Ralph Talbot were the destroyers, and they were there to give warning of incoming Japanese. They had radar, and they were supposed to pick them up. The Japanese sailed straight between them. Neither ship saw them. And it was particularly strange in the case of the Blue because the Blue almost collided with the Japanese task force. Still didn't see them. The destroyer Blue was apparently so concerned about running aground, so all of her lookouts were looking at Cape Esperance, Tassafaronga, on Guadalcanal to make sure they didn't run aground, that none of them were looking into the slot to see if Japanese ships were coming. Now, it's more complicated than that. The type of radar the Blue had did not work well at picking up ships, especially among islands. Her crewmen were tired. We didn't have trained lookouts like the Japanese did. And there was always a problem, and it was pointed out by General Vandegrift, that if a captain ran his ship aground, well, his career was over. So the Blue was more concerned about running aground than she was about meeting the Japanese. And then the final act, which to me is the most inexplicable, is Captain Bodie on the USS Chicago. He's fighting the Japanese. He sees that they're attacking. He doesn't tell anybody. He doesn't send out a radio saying, warning, warning, strange ships are here. It was the USS Patterson that did that.
And we're not talking a couple. We've got eight Japanese ships have slipped through.
Yeah, there was the cruiser Admiral Mikawa's flagship Chokai, which was really, I call it luxurious, and it was. It had one of the biggest bridges of any Japanese ship. It was more like a battleship's bridge. It was a very popular flagship, the Chokai was, and she was a beast. You had four older light cruisers of the 6th Cruiser Division under Admiral Goto, the Elba, Kako, Kinugasa, Furutaka. You had the 18th Cruiser Division with the Tenryu, Yubori, light cruisers. And then you had one destroyer, Yunagi. This was a scratch force. The Japanese just slapped this force together. Mikawa was very aggressive. He knew what the stakes were and how quickly this had to be squelched. And he said, okay, let's get all these ships together. Let's go. And he came up with the plan on the fly. It was a simple plan with simple identification. And we still couldn't get that at that time. We still had problems with ship identification. He struck hard. He ended up sinking four cruisers, damaging another one. There was so much craziness during this battle. Just so much craziness. The U.S. captains, they were, especially in the Northern Force, they were convinced they were being attacked by their own ships. Friendly fire. Well, there's no fire is friendly. If someone's firing at you, it can kill you. That means it's not friendly, okay? And some of that was because they didn't have any warning of it. And some of it was because they came from a bureaucratic mindset. They couldn't imagine that the Japanese were coming. They hadn't paid attention to some of the reports that, well, they might come tonight. You might want to be ready. One captain did. That was the captain of the destroyer Patterson. In the midst of the battle, the captain of the USS Chicago, Captain Bodie, he ends up arguing with his gunnery officer over who commands the radar.
It just seems to show how green the Americans' sort of navy still was in many respects. We're still trying to work out procedure rather than they were not untrained. They were trying to work out how they were using the toys that they got in together.
Yeah, and this was really our first surface action of the war. The Java Sea campaign, those ships were so isolated, they were so old, and so many of them were lost, that they could not impart that experience on the rest of the fleet. It was a night action, and we couldn't imagine people fighting at night. I mean, you can't see.
Mm. It's just a series of debacles. Did they learn anything, do you think? The American Navy, U.S. Navy, from that night?
Oh, you learn plenty of things. You learn more from defeat than from victory. They did a report, trying to assign blame for it. The only one who got the blame, who was actually punished, was Captain Bodie. And I think that's justified because when he didn't tell anyone the Japanese ships were there, that it was so egregious that the first thing you do is you tell people, you warn them, the enemy is here. Those are the two commodities that are at a premium in any military situation. Communications, information. And they're intertwined. Good communications are worthless if you don't have anything to tell. Good information is worthless if you can't get it to the right people who can actually do something with it. Captain Bodie had both, and he exercised neither. And so that was the critical failure in the situation, in my mind, and in the U.S. Navy's mind, ultimately. They did a 400-page report, the Naval War College, later on, after the war. The lessons were, we need better training, especially for night actions. We needed better identification of friend or foe, better situational awareness. Crushley couldn't have done much more than what he did in terms of deployment of his ships, except the picket destroyers could have been put out much further. We needed to realize the value of cruiser scout planes, especially at night. The first warning we had of Savo Island was actually the appearance of a scout plane. And people were just, it's friendly. A Marine officer in Guadalcanal who realized it was an enemy scout plane and that something was going on. The Japanese are very aggressive in their use of scout planes. They'd use the float planes, rather. They'd use them at night. They'd use them in bad weather. They were very creative, very aggressive in their use, and we were not, and we could not conceive of it. We saw that scout plane flying over. Yeah, it must be friendly.
It's a strange overconfidence in themselves just to believe it's their own.
Not just confidence, but there still was a sort of racism about. There were jokes about Japanese eyesight. I'm sorry. The Japanese eyesight outperformed U.S. radar at that and many other actions. They had trained lookouts on their ships. They were specifically chosen because they had good eyesight. They had oversized binoculars that even had some polarizing lenses that cleared out haze. We just picked anyone who was available.
It's after this, the Navy is now withdrawing, leaving the Marines. They haven't finished unloading. The Marines are kind of left... with her ass hanging out, really, with, you know, just over a month's supply, no heavy equipment. I just wondered if that actually played into the hands of the Japanese, the Navy. They're not abandoning the Marines. They're just withdrawing before everything's fully unloaded.
Well, yeah, but to the Marines, especially right after the disaster off Savile Island, and they saw the results of it the next morning. They called it the Battle of the Five Sitting Ducks. They felt they were being abandoned. Part of the problem at the time was that we didn't know quite how long this was going to take. We didn't know quite what we were doing. There was a philosophy called makey-learney. It was this very operation that exemplified it. Admiral King told Admiral Turner, yeah, you're going to be my Pacific amphibious expert. You're going to be in charge of all amphibious operations in the South Pacific. Admiral Turner's like, I don't know anything about amphibious operations. And Admiral King was responding, you will learn. Now, that wasn't totally true because Admiral Turner had studied amphibious operations. It was a hobby for him. But we had never done this. He had never done it. They had never practiced it. They had to assemble the amphibious equipment. They had to assemble the supplies. They had to assemble the troops, the 1st Marine Division. That was General Vandegrift's job. This was something completely new. Learning on the fly is basically it. We're going to do it. We'll make mistakes, but we'll learn from those mistakes. And a year later, we were doing these amphibious operations, bam, bam, bam. Very efficient. To start out with, it was chaos. We'd have enough people unloading the transports. They had to get underway to avoid air attack. We didn't have them combat loaded, so the most essential supplies were the ones that would be taken out first. We didn't know any of that stuff at this point. Turner did not get the transports unloaded as quickly as would be shown to be possible later on, but Admiral Fletcher gave him very little to work with. So the Marines were very fortunate that the Japanese had left so much behind when they panicked and ran into the jungle. It's like the Special Naval Landing Force troops, they're called Japanese Marines, but they're really just naval infantry. They have a reputation for never surrendering to the enemy. And this operation shows why they have that reputation for never surrendering, because they just run away. And that's what they did. They just ran to the jungle. The Japanese had started this airfield without a plan for defending it and without a way of comfortably supporting it. This airfield was about 600 miles from their biggest air base at Rabaul, Vunakuninau and the Lakunai airfields at Rabaul. And it was at the very edge of the range for the Japanese Zero fighters. When the Japanese would send bombers down from Rabaul to attack the airfield, the fighters couldn't stay very long. They couldn't stay very long to deal with American interceptors because they were at their bingo fuel once they arrived. They had to turn around and head back very quickly. It had maybe 10 minutes of combat they could deal with.
But the Americans quickly get Henderson Field, as it becomes known, working. And I guess those 10 minutes is crucial for the pilots of Henderson Field to get up and get at them. Life was generally horrendous for the Marines. It's, you know, it's a real slog for them. How was it for the pilots?
Well, imagine all of the negatives of being a combat pilot combined with all the negatives of being an infantryman and all the negatives of being on Guadalcanal. And that's what you have for the pilots that were ultimately based at what became known as Henderson Field, that airfield on Guadalcanal that the Japanese built. When we think of the South Pacific, we think palm trees, we think beaches, warm weather, sun, the breezes coming off the ocean, you know, women in bikinis and grass skirts. And that's not the Solomon Islands. That's not Guadalcanal. Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands has a jungle that's almost primordial. They have two wet seasons, the wet and the dry season, but the Marines called them the wet and the really wet season. It rained almost every day, and the jungle was so thick that oftentimes the sun did not reach the ground. In fact, it wouldn't reach the ground for very long periods of time. And so with that water down there, you would get mold. You would get all kinds of strange microbes growing up. The main resident of Guadalcanal was the mosquitoes. The eastern perimeter of Henderson Field on Guadalcanal was something called Alligator Creek. It was a body of water called Alligator Creek. even though it had no alligators and was not a creek. They called it Alligator Creek. It was actually the Elu River, even though it's not really a river, it's more of a tidal lagoon. There's this lie about Guadalcanal. I call Guadalcanal a lie. There have been so many authors that say it looks like paradise, but it's actually paradise lost. And that's the truth. I call it pandemonium, which was and you notice in the book, I have a strange spelling of pandemonium. That's out of Milton. That's his capital of hell. Because Guadalcanal was hell for so many people. The dirt there was a special black stinking dirt that got into everything. Even the plants were hostile. You've got the kunai grass, which is about 6 feet tall and is sharp as a sword, and it caused lacerations to people. It's a tropical hell. And that's what the Marines found out. It was probably the worst for the pilots because, you know, pilots are normally, you know, on carriers or on land bases, they're treated, you know, somewhat like celebrities. You have to have a certain confidence about you if you're going to fly a plane, especially in combat. And so they often get the best quarters. They get, you know, treated because there's so much pressure to being a combat pilot. And on Guadalcanal, they couldn't have any of that. They had to live like the infantry. They'd be in tents where the ground was mud, and their cots would sink into the mud. That's where they had cots at all and didn't have to sleep on straw mats. And if they had straw mats, good luck sleeping. And every day and every night, the Japanese would they put together something called the R Area Air Force. They assembled all their float planes into the R Area Air Force. All the land-based planes in the Imperial Japanese Navy were under the aegis of the 11th Air Fleet. Operationally, they weren't called that. They were called Base Air Force. Base Air Force would attack every day around the same time. They call it Tojo time, maybe like 11:03. They'd have to take off after dawn. It'd take them a certain amount of time to fly down the slot or the Guadal Highway. The Australians were brave and brilliant, and they formed something called Ferdinand, which is known popularly as the Coast Watchers. They seeded the Solomon Islands with former troops, former government officials, plantation owners. They gave them radios, and they would tell us of any ship movement, of any aircraft they saw flying over. They gave us warning before we had radar installed on Guadalcanal. They gave us great warning. They did a great job. It was just absolute brilliance by the Australians, and one man, I believe his name was Felt, to set it up, and they saved so many lives in World War II. They were not to do combat. They were there just to warn. But yeah, we'd get the warning, and so we could send the aircraft up, and the Japanese would compound things by – they didn't put radios in their fighters in the Japanese Zero. It had no radio except for the flight leaders.
Seems remarkably backwards for such an advanced piece of equipment.
There are so many instances where the Japanese – yeah, Japanese Zeros available to fight, and they would just, you know, circle around not doing anything because they couldn't see the enemy, and no one could tell them where the enemy was because they didn't have radios. It's just, it's like penny wise and yen foolish. It was so stupid. It saved 40 pounds in weight. Again, communications, information. The Japanese denied themselves both when they took the radios, when they said no radios in the Japanese Zeros. And that was something else about this campaign. Because the Japanese had not built any bases, any air bases closer to Guadalcanal, it was not within a zone where they could comfortably be supported. They had to fly that 600 miles from Rabaul and then fly back. So if you're injured, if your plane is shot up over Guadalcanal, you somehow have to make it 600 miles back to Rabaul. And Saburo Sakai, the famous Japanese aviator, famous Japanese fighter ace, he was shot and his combat career ended the first day on Guadalcanal when he attacked some SBD Dauntlesses, and they were their tail gunners just raked his fighter up. He took a bullet through the top of his head. His skull was actually exposed, and he was blinded in one eye, and he had blood all over him. He was fighting to stay conscious. and he flew the 600 miles back to Rabaul.
It's remarkable, isn't it? When you go over some of the casualty figures, you know, and how many of the Americans actually find their way back from. It's Cactus, the Cactus Force, isn't it, that's on the island, they dub them. And some of those lads must have been repeatedly knocked out of the sky, but keep flying. And their problem is not so much the pilots as getting the planes, whereas the Japanese seem to be on a, well, they're losing both. But, you know, pilots become more of a problem.
Well, it's both, because, you know, the pilots had to fight every day, but they have to live like infantrymen. They don't get any sleep because that R Area Air Force I told you about, they send aircraft over, one called Louis the Louse. He would drop a few, he was a float plane. He'd drop a few bombs. He'd drop a few flares, just keep everyone awake. Base Air Force would send over someone called, that was known as Washing Machine Charlie. His engines were especially loud and obnoxious, and he would drop bombs, keep everyone awake. So they couldn't really sleep. And that over time would start to take a toll. They didn't have a whole lot of food on Guadalcanal. I mean, they had food. You're eating, and then you're going up to a high altitude. And so if you're eating something like sausage or Spam, there was so much Spam on Guadalcanal. This had to be Monty Python in action. And you get up to high altitude, well, the pressure is not as great up there. And so the gases expand in your stomach, and that is massive indigestion, and it's serious for someone at high altitude. You needed the oxygen masks for high altitude also. When your oxygen failed, well, you're going to fall asleep from hypoxia. We lost a number of pilots that way. The Air Cobra, the P-400, it did not have an oxygen supply at all, so the pilots could not go up to altitude to deal with the zeros. They had to stay at a lower altitude, and then normally an altitude advantage is critical in air battles, normally, not always, but normally. They were shredded by the zeros. These were good Army pilots, but we did have what I call the home field advantage. If we're shot down over Guadalcanal, if you can make it to the ground and survive, there's a good chance you were going to make it back to the airfield and be put back into combat. The Japanese could not make that assumption. If a Japanese fighter, a bomber, was shot down over Guadalcanal, they likely would never fly again. They couldn't get back to Rabaul. They'd be found by hostile natives. That distance was critical in so many ways. The Japanese were so short-sighted in not building intermediate bases to support Guadalcanal before they started building the airfield there.
And there is ground troops in Guadalcanal, and they keep feeding them in, as the Americans also sort of feed more men, but they seem to completely inept on the ground against the Marines, who are on limited resources, but seem to convincingly repel them.
The Japanese, they were sending land troops to take back the airfield, which makes sense. The Japanese had this thing about seeing what they wanted to see. I remember Admiral Nagano reporting to the Emperor, well, it's not going to be a problem taking back the airfield, because there are only like 2,000 Americans on Guadalcanal. They're only there to destroy it and then to leave. Who told you that? Oh, the Russians. And if anyone knows what's going on in the South Pacific, it would be the Russians. They got it from their attaché in Moscow that the Americans had 2,000 troops on Guadalcanal. It never occurred to the Japanese to ask, how would the Russians know this? They wanted to believe it, so they believed it. They sent in something called the Ichiki Detachment to take back the airfield. It was led by a guy named Colonel Ichiki, hence the name Ichiki Detachment. He landed at Taivu Point, east of the airfield, and he set about marching in to take it. His first problem was that he was starting to string along telephone line, and he sent a whole bunch of officers to do that, and they were ambushed by an American patrol, who then took the officers' maps. He did not consider that the Americans might actually send patrols out this far. The other problem with Colonel Ichiki's plan is that he was like a lot of officers in the Imperial Japanese Army. He was a practitioner and a firm believer in what was called bamboo spear tactics. The Imperial Japanese Army, they had relatively modern weapons. They had rifles. They had machine guns. But their preferred method of attacking was to fix bayonets inside their rifles and do a mass charge at night when they're shouting, "Banzai!" And even if the enemy was superior in technology or superior in numbers, well, the mass charge with bayonets and swords would take advantage of the superior spiritual power of the Japanese soldier. That was the theory. Hey, it worked against the Chinese. So he marches straight from Taiwu Point, straight toward the airfield. And then he finds that the Americans also have rifles. They have machine guns. They have anti-tank guns. They have mortars. They have grenades. And unlike Colonel Ichiki, they're very happy to use them. And so Colonel Ichiki charged across a spit of land that went across Alligator Creek, Ilu River, whatever you want to call it, and they were mowed down in droves. It was like a tornado through a cornfield. And so he tried three attacks. They were beaten back three times with severe losses. Ultimately, Colonel Ichiki, he died. It's disputed how he died. He either committed suicide or he was killed in combat. That was the first attack by Colonel Ichiki and the first attack by the Japanese, and it ended in failure, which the Japanese army reported as not completely successful.
But they seem to be repeatedly, you know, keep cocking up and not dissimilar lines. They seem quite inept, really, the Japanese ground attacks.
The Japanese army had exactly one good general, and that general was not on Guadalcanal. That general was the one who took Singapore and Malaya. That was General Yamashita, and defended the Philippines. So the Japanese started their second attack on Guadalcanal to try to retake the airfield. They used the remnants of the Ichiki detachment, and they brought in a guy named General Kawaguchi. And he came in with his 35th Brigade. And he landed on Guadalcanal with his troops, at the same point Colonel Ichiki landed, Taiwu Point. And he thought Colonel Ichiki's plan was sort of stupid. They march from Taiwu Point, launch a banzai charge at the airfield. Where's the creativity in that? General Kawaguchi was going to go into the jungle south of the airfield and then launch a banzai charge. So he arrives on Guadalcanal with a hydrographic map of the north coast of Guadalcanal that does not show the route he is supposed to take to attack the airfield. But map's a map, you know, map's a map. And he had one compass that was 20 to 40 degrees off. He sets up a supply base near Taiwu Point. He leaves a guard, mostly with the old members of the Ichiki detachment, and then he marches inland. He cuts his way through the jungle to get south of the airfield and begin his attack from a surprise direction. The next day, the day after he leaves, he finds out that American raiders have landed at Taiwu Point. This runner comes in and says, "The Americans have landed at our supply base. What are we supposed to do?" Because up until that point, most of the Japanese had just stood around watching the Americans, not knowing what to do. I mean, there were a few shots fired, but they were like, and this is Mike Edson's Raiders, or Red Mike Edson's Raiders, raiding the Japanese supply base. They got maps. They got the list of Japanese units. They got all the Japanese food, but they couldn't take with them. They destroyed it. They took all the Japanese anti-tank guns and destroyed them. They took the Japanese radio. They took all kinds of intelligence. They took General Kawaguchi's white suit that he was planning on wearing for the surrender of Hendersonville. So Kawaguchi's supply base was destroyed behind him, again, by his poor planning and by the lack of initiative, of individual initiative by the Japanese army. Kawaguchi starts hacking his way inland with his troops to get south of the airfield. He divides them into four columns, which, since the compass is 20 to 40 degrees off and they can't see any landmarks because of the jungle, they start wavering everywhere like a drunk driver. And at one point, they end up running into each other. So they end up in one big column. They get south of the airfield, and then Kawaguchi sees a ridge between him and the airfield. That's another great example of General Kawaguchi's planning. He didn't have the proper map, so he didn't know that ridge was there. And he's stunned to find that a ridge is there. Completely stunned, angry, he has no choice but to attack over it. Despite coming back with the Japanese plans, General Vandegrift refuses to accept that the Japanese are going to attack from the south. So he only allows Mike Edson's raiders, Marine Raider Battalion, to be put there, ostensibly to rest. The troops get suspicious when Edson starts having them dig foxholes and string up barbed wire and everything. This is in mid-September 1942. Kawaguchi tries to attack. The problem is he's attacking out of the jungle, the very thick jungle. It's difficult enough to get into the starting point positions from which you're going to launch the attack. And units get there late, if they get there at all. And so he launched the attack, but a whole bunch of units got shunted off to the side of the ridge into a swamp. There was lots of shooting, disorganized. No one knew what was going on. Kawaguchi does a double facepalm, calls everyone back. Let's try it again tomorrow night. The following night, Kawaguchi has all of his units lined up. They're ready to attack up the ridge, attack the Marines, and one of them attacks early. This is another example of that individual Japanese initiative where they shout, "Banzai!" and charge the enemy at random times. That happened on this night. They launched an attack about 3 hours early and pushed the Marines back a bit, and then they stopped because they saw a Marine supply cache of food, and they were hungry. So they all stopped attacking to eat the food. And Kawaguchi launches attack around 9 p.m. He has a massive numerical advantage over the Marines on this ridge, and he keeps pushing them back. But it's the same thing as in General Ichiki's attack. It's a bamboo spear, banzai charge. They're getting machine gunned. They're getting hit by artillery. Just massive losses. They've had one unit lost because it's busy eating the American food. The others are, they keep pushing the Marines back just by sheer weight of numbers. But they'd warned the Marines when an attack was coming, when a banzai charge was coming, because they'd shoot up a rocket just beforehand. They'd keep these banzai charges going. The Marines were starting to lose troops, and Colonel Edson needed more men and more ammunition. And General Vandegrift started realizing there was a problem, and so he started feeding in some reserve troops finally. And they ended up holding the ridge. And this was called the Battle of Bloody Ridge. It's also known as the Battle of Edson's Ridge, because there are bloody ridges in just about every war across the world. This was the time when Guadalcanal came closest to falling. A couple Japanese squads actually got through to a satellite airfield of Henderson Field. But they were too small, they were too isolated, and they were dealt with. And General Kawaguchi, they don't know how many troops they lost. It was severe. Kawaguchi was in tears about it. And then he got in even more tears when he found out one of his units hadn't even attacked. I mean, he came this close to winning. One of his units hadn't even attacked. The commander had gone to see Kawaguchi to get some instructions from him, couldn't find Kawaguchi, and then got caught in the jungle by the American attack and was pinned down. He couldn't move. He also had some injury of some sort. And so his unit did not have him, its commander, there. So they just sat there like topiary and did nothing. And Kawaguchi was furious, but then he found out the commander had been injured, and so he relented. So that attack failed, and a big reason it failed was the lack of that one unit. Kawaguchi thought that that one unit would have made the difference. And that was the closest the Japanese came to taking Henderson Field.
It's amazing how inept they were. But the Americans themselves are having a command shuffle about somewhere on this point, where Gormley's replaced with Halsey. They're two very different characters.
The Marines and the Navy people and the Army people at the airfield, they were tough. They were ready to fight. They were willing to fight. The pilots were willing to go into the jungle. The air commander, General Geiger, was going to stay on Guadalcanal. He wasn't going to leave. They were ready for the worst, and they were ready to deal with it. Who was not ready to deal with it was Admiral Gormley, far away in Noumea. He declared it a disaster and that he couldn't fight it without more troops. And that's not what Admiral Nimitz wanted to hear. And this is kind of subtle in many respects. Gormley would say things like, I can't fight this unless I have more troops. General Vandegrift would say, I can fight this, but I need more troops. It's very subtle, but it's a mindset, and Admiral Nimitz picked up on it. Gormley never visited Guadalcanal, and he admitted he didn't know the abilities of the forces under his command, and that is a serious blunder. He stayed on his transport Argonne, which was nicknamed the Agony Maru, in Nomea, and it was later theorized that he was suffering from abscessed teeth, and he was in such pain from it that he couldn't think clearly. He had proceeded from the beginning that he didn't want this operation. He didn't think he was going to succeed. He acted as if it wouldn't succeed. He held back a lot of forces. Nimitz came down there to check on him, and he wasn't happy with what he saw. He saw a lot of forces being held back, and Gormley just saw problems. He'd get a note about what the Japanese had done, and he'd say, my God, what are we going to do about this? He wouldn't see them as opportunities. He would see them as disasters. He went into full panic mode after the bombardment by the Congo and the Haruna. Plus, the U.S. Navy had no ships around there. The Marines kept asking, where the hell is the U.S. Navy? And Nimitz had been asking, where the hell is the U.S. Navy? Why are the Japanese able to do these bombardments? Where are our ships? Gormley had battleships. He kept them way back from the front for reasons Nimitz was never able to figure out. In fairness, we had exactly one aircraft carrier left after Japanese submarines, in tune with Admiral Fletcher's original fears, they put a torpedo in the carrier Saratoga. The Enterprise was damaged at Eastern Solomons. Then the Wasp, in an incredible attack that's still not entirely explained, took at least two torpedoes that ruptured her fuel system and set the entire carrier ablaze. And you see the pictures of the carrier, they're just haunting pictures, just so much smoke. And you wonder how anyone could survive it because there was so much fire beneath decks. The water mains on the carrier would not work. And so they could not get the water to even fight the fires. And to this day, there's a dispute as to why that happened. But what it meant was the carrier was just burned to hell. And so she had to be scuttled. So the only carrier we had left was the Hornet. The Hornet held the line for a month. But Gormley kept her out of position to support Guadalcanal. The admiral in charge of the Hornet Task Force, Admiral Murray, was furious about it. He wanted to support Guadalcanal. He knew that his air power was needed to stop these bombardments. Well, Admiral Gormley wouldn't have it. It's too risky to the Hornet. And there is some support for that thinking. If that's our last carrier in the Pacific, our last operational carrier, you got to take care of it. But this is your offensive here. It's hanging by a thread. You are almost daring the Japanese to come with the scissors. Because the Japanese were looking for the Hornet. They wanted to sink her, being the last American carrier in the Pacific. Admiral Murray was pretty smart about how he handled it. And he took full advantage of the U.S. scout planes and the information they provided. So the Japanese would come down looking for the Hornet. The Hornet would retreat. Then they couldn't find her. They gave up looking for the Hornet, so they pulled back. The Hornet would come back. Then the Japanese would hear about the Hornet, so they'd send their carriers down looking for the Hornet. The Hornet would then pull back because Japanese carriers would always be spotted by our scout planes. And so the Hornet knew when they had returned, and so the Hornet would pull back. The Japanese would give up on finding her. They'd pull back. Then the Hornet would return. The Japanese could not get the Hornet. But Gormley was way overprotective of her, aside from one failed raid on Shortlands that contributed to the crisis that appeared in mid-October with the bombardment of the Congo and the Haruna. In fact, that crisis started all the way back with Fletcher abandoning the Marines on Guadalcanal before they could get their supplies unloaded. They never really got a firm foothold on Guadalcanal because of the supply situation and because Admiral Gormley held so much back. And because we really weren't quite ready for that offensive, but the timing of it was not by choice. It the Japanese sort of forced the issue by completion of the airfield.
So he's replaced with Halsey, who's very much more dynamic.
Yes, Admiral Halsey was really our most experienced carrier commander and our most aggressive one. He'd commanded the Enterprise Task Force at the beginning of the war. It was he who sailed the Enterprise into Pearl Harbor the day after the attack, and he saw the devastation wrought by the Japanese. And he was very aggressive. He was a good carrier admiral. He was an inspiration to his men. He would fight from the front. He would fight. He would support them. They would back him up. He would visit them. Gormley had not visited Guadalcanal. Well, Halsey would. He would talk to the men. He was very popular with them, very energetic. Everything Gormley was not. So he took over. The first thing he told Vandegrift was, I'm going to give you everything I've got. He wanted to attack the Japanese, where Gormley was playing as if he had already lost and Fletcher was playing not to lose. Admiral Halsey would play to win. And the effect of his appointment to command the South Pacific Forces was just electric. The ship crews were excited. The people on Guadalcanal, the Marines, the air crews, they felt like they had hope again. Just by the name Halsey. In fact, they got into fist fights, whether Halsey was worth two battleships or worth three battleships. That's the effect of a good commander, a commander who's an inspiration to his troops. But Halsey was not perfect. He develops a plan that's supposed to be like the Battle of Midway, where we have carriers sitting in ambush on the Japanese flank, and they don't realize we're there. While the carriers are trying to attack Midway, we go and attack the carriers and we sink them. Well, he decides to try a replay of that. And now that the Enterprise was back, he had two carriers. He decides to send his carriers up near the Santa Cruz Islands, where they would be on the flank of the Japanese when their carriers came down from Truk or came down from their locations in Japan. One problem was that Halsey seems to have wanted the carriers to stay within some reasonable land-based air coverage. They weren't supposed to engage the Japanese if they had to go like north of the Santa Cruz Islands. That didn't make it into the orders to the admiral commanding it, Admiral Kincaid. So Admiral Kincaid kept the Enterprise and the Hornet heading north. But Halsey, he did try to get his communications right. He wanted a completely new staff from Admiral Gormley because Admiral Gormley's staff was infected by his defeatism. And so he wanted a new communications officer, and he wanted his old communications officer from the Enterprise, a guy named Dow. Dow was the fighter director on the Enterprise. He was a pretty good one, but Halsey really needed his communications. And so Halsey called Dow down to Nomea to work on his communications. And the Enterprise had a fighter direction was taken over by an officer named Griffin. Now, he was very good with the theory of fighter direction. And fighter direction is like if you're on an aircraft carrier and you have fighters trying to protect the carrier and the enemy's coming, and you see on radar the enemy's coming from the northwest, you radio the fighters to go ahead to the northwest. That's where the enemy is. And there are a lot of things you have to consider in fighter direction. You have to consider the fuel situation of the planes, the oxygen situation of the planes, a number of factors like the airspeed, altitude, all kinds of things. And Griffin was very familiar with the theory of it. He had taught the theory of fighter direction. He had learned it from the Royal Air Force, but he did not have battle experience. It turned out that the fighter director on the carrier Hornet, Fleming, he had plenty of experience, and the Hornet had a lot of confidence in him. But Griffin was on the flagship of the overall task force, and so Admiral Kincaid pulled rank, and Griffin was going to be in charge of all fighter direction. Halsey pulling back his communications officer on the eve of battle, that ended up being a critical decision and a very questionable one on Halsey's part. We had this radar. We were proud of this radar. We were happy to have this radar. And the radar was very good at picking up incoming Japanese planes, except this late October day, because the radar on the Enterprise and the Hornet did not pick up anything. And no one knows why. The radar on the escorting ships picked up enemy aircraft, but they assumed the Enterprise and the Hornet picked it up too, so they didn't say anything. These aircraft were coming in, and Kincaid and Griffin were getting a sense that something was seriously wrong. They sent their aircraft up. Griffin positioned them at about 10,000 feet to not use their oxygen too early. There are just so many sub-stories in the overall story of the battle. The Americans launch an airstrike just to get the fighters off the decks because we don't quite know where the Japanese carriers are. Japanese know where we are, so they launch an airstrike, and the two airstrikes pass each other, and they're all staring at each other like gangs in the old West. Okay, who's going to draw first? Who's going to draw first? One Zero pilot who was supposed to escort the torpedo bombers and dive bombers, well, he decided it'd be more fun to attack the Americans. He comes up behind the American airstrike. The American fighters are actually ahead of the American torpedo bombers, the Avengers, and none of them see what goes on behind them, which is these Japanese Zeros chewing up our torpedo bombers. They don't see it until it's too late and they're cut off. All they can do is keep going on ahead, escorting the dive bombers, while four American fighters are left behind to deal with these Japanese Zeros. And they're chewed up, but they shoot down half the Zeros in return. The Zeros have used up all their ammunition. They've used up their fuel. They have to go home. Commander Griffin has all his planes at 10,000 feet, and the Japanese dive bombers and their fighters are much higher. So he's mispositioned them, and the defending fighters can't gain altitude quickly enough, and they can't get into position to stop the Japanese from getting to the Hornet. So the Japanese attack the Hornet. They get a couple bomb hits on her, but the real problem is the torpedoes, and this is where the lack of fighters becomes a problem because they're not suppressing the anti-aircraft fire from the Hornet or her escorts. And so the anti-aircraft fire is like nothing the Japanese have ever seen. In the course of attacking the Hornet, they lost probably the best torpedo attack commander in the world, who was shot down by anti-aircraft fire. In his last attack, though, he got a hit on the Hornet, and it was a critical hit because it went into one of her engine rooms, and she lost power, and she could not move. She couldn't do anything. And to make matters worse, one of the dive bombers was apparently it was a fire, and so the pilot may have been dead already, but he plowed into the Hornet's island superstructure and onto the signal bridge, and flaming gasoline was spewed everywhere and just incinerated almost everyone on the signal bridge. Strangely enough, though, its bomb did not explode. The Hornet was completely disabled. On their way out, the Japanese spotted the Enterprise. And so, yeah, there's another carrier. We got to go attack them. They were scattered in their return, though. They were so shot up by anti-aircraft fire and by avenging fighter pilots who were very angry at Commander Griffin for mispositioning them that they were chewed up on the flight back. They were separated. The Japanese aircraft that returned to Kido Butai were not in combat formation. They were more like ones and twos. We had a lot of communications problems this day. The reports that we should have gotten about where the Japanese carriers were did not get through. Just everything technically that could go wrong this day did. But two of our scout planes found the Japanese carrier, and they dove on one of them. The carrier turned out to be the light carrier Zuiho. They dropped two bombs that landed near her stern. But that's a very sensitive part of the ship. That's where the arresting wires are that stop aircraft when they land. And the two bomb hits weren't threatening, but they destroyed the arresting wires. So the Zuiho could no longer recover aircraft. So she was useless for the rest of the operation. The American aircraft were all scattered, both by the attack and by these sort of discombobulated nature of their launches. And the Japanese had this weird tactic as well. They would have a carrier force here. They'd have a cruiser force there. They'd have a battleship force here. They'd spread them out. The Battle of Midway, they had so many forces that we were able to isolate the carrier force and sink the carriers. And that's the risk of it. So it had not worked at Coral Sea. It had not worked at Midway. It had not worked at Eastern Solomons. But Admiral Yamamoto figured it had to work eventually. So they kept trying it. Since none of the reports of the Japanese carriers ever got through, our forces were left saying, well, is there anything else around here we can attack? We can't find the carriers. Yeah, there's a cruiser. Let's go attack it. They didn't keep pressing for the carriers. They just decided, eh, might as well just hit the cruiser. And so the cruiser Chikuma, it's one of those weird heavy cruiser seaplane carrier things that the Japanese had. She ended up being the recipient of quite a few bombing attacks, and only by the smart actions of her captain was she able to survive. Ultimately, only one airstrike found the Japanese carriers without fighter escort. That was the Dauntlesses, Dauntless dive bombers, and they were so harassed by Zeros, they had to dive from a shallower angle than they prefer, but they got Admiral Nagumo's flagship Shokaku. They plastered her with at least 6 bombs into the flight deck. Now, at Midway, that would have been fatal, but the Japanese had learned from Midway. The aircraft carrier was empty of aircraft. The fuel lines were not running. And so while the carrier was burning, had severe damage, the engines were still functional, and the carrier was, her watertight integrity was still good. So the carrier was going to be saved. They just had to get her home. So the carrier starts heading home. The Japanese see the Enterprise there, and they decide to assemble all these aircraft on the remaining carriers, the Zuikaku, and this other weird carrier called the Junyo that was commanded by an admiral named Kakuda. He basically took charge at this point, and he kept launching air attacks on the Enterprise. And you have to keep in mind that the Enterprise had to take her own aircraft, plus that of the Hornet, because they couldn't land on the Hornet. All these fighters were running low on fuel. They had to land and take off again. So there are a whole bunch of aircraft in the air running out of fuel from 2 carriers, and the Japanese are coming. So the Enterprise can't take the aircraft on board, and Commander Griffin has to go out once again and tell the fighters where to go. It works out a little bit better because the Japanese, this was their second airstrike that Nagumo had launched. They got a few bomb hits on the Enterprise, ended up jamming one of her elevators, ended up rupturing some hull plating, destroying some of her officers' quarters, and those planes couldn't land. But the Enterprise got the damage repaired very, very quickly, and so she was able to at least try and rotate some of the planes in and out to get, you know, something fueled, something up. But the Japanese kept attacking in penny packets. The Enterprise had first launched her aircraft in the early morning. She couldn't recover aircraft until mid-afternoon. There were so many attacks, so she could not recover aircraft. And finally, Commander Griffin got his sea legs under him and started positioning aircraft properly by the end of the attacks. The bomb hits on the Enterprise were serious. The damage was more serious than thought, but she evaded all the torpedoes. And that was a miracle, considering how many had been aimed at her. So she fought off those attacks. She started recovering the aircraft, but she was damaged. She was the last operational carrier in the Pacific for the U.S. Navy. So Admiral Kincaid decided, okay, we're in over our heads. We've had enough. We better go home. The people on the Hornet were not happy about it. They were getting the Hornet under tow, and they were about to restore power to her. They had started rigging everything. They're getting the power up in one of her boiler rooms. And then another strike from the Junyo caught her. It was 6 planes. This should tell you just how far the Japanese had fallen, because they got only, this carrier is almost stationary, and they got only 2 hits. One of those was a dud. All the planes were shot down, but the torpedo that hit the one remaining engine room. So now there was no way to restore power on the Hornet. She could not. She would have to be towed all the way to port. And the Japanese were coming. They had sent their surface forces forward to try to catch the American carriers with their battleships at night. I don't know why he fantasized about this, but he kept doing this again and again throughout the war. He tried it at Midway. He tried at Eastern Solomons. He tried it now. So he was sending his battleships forward, and there was no way to get the Hornet moving, and there was no way to tow her. So they decided to abandon her. And the Japanese keep mounting attacks on the Hornet. They got like one bomb hit on her on a stationary carrier. This is how bad the Japanese Sea Eagles, as they called their naval air pilots, had been shot up, not just at Santa Cruz, especially Santa Cruz, because of the heavy anti-aircraft fire. When their pilots got back to their carriers, they were shell-shocked. Some of them couldn't even report properly what they had seen. They lost so many flight leaders. The U.S. lost one. The Japanese lost a half dozen. It was just devastating to Japanese air power. But they were still winning the battle. The Enterprise on the run. The Hornet was disabled. We had to get rid of her. So we leave the destroyers Mustin and Anderson there. Okay, you're supposed to scuttle the Hornet. So Mustin goes in there, fires 8 torpedoes. Well, 3 of those torpedoes run wild. 2 of them don't hit, and nobody knows why. No one knows what happened to them. And then 3 hit, but the carrier doesn't sink. Bring in the destroyer Anderson. Anderson launches, 8 torpedoes. Of those 8 aimed at a stationary target, 6 of them hit, but 2 of those are duds. Still, she doesn't sink. So the destroyers start shooting at her with their 5-inch guns. They're hoping to set off one of the fuel tanks or something like the Japanese had done to the Wasp. They can't do that. And finally, when Japanese ships appear on their radar approaching, the 2 destroyers flee. And the Japanese come and they capture the Hornet. This was about the first time in eons a U.S. ship was left to the mercies of the enemy. Abandoned, derelict, burning. It only took them 2 of their torpedoes to sink the Hornet.
So was the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands, can we chalk that up as a Japanese victory?
We lost that battle tactically. Well, and that is a legitimate question. And let me get to that by starting here, because what prompted the Battle of Santa Cruz Islands was the 3rd Japanese attack on Guam on the airfield, the Japanese Army attack. Because the Japanese Army general had said, all right, no more Mr. Nice Guy. I'm going down the Guadalcanal and I'm going to take charge of this myself. General Hayakutake was his name. He goes down there and he takes charge. They landed on Western Guadalcanal and they were going to burrow into the jungle and attack from the south, just like Kawaguchi did. And Kawaguchi was part of this force. But also part of this force was a guy, a colonel named Masanobu Tsuji. And he was with Imperial General Headquarters. And so he was attached to this latest attack on Henderson Field as their representative. As the Japanese army troops are approaching their starting point again on the south side of Henderson Field to attack, Colonel Tsuji sees an opportunity to have General Kawaguchi replaced, because he doesn't like General Kawaguchi, because Kawaguchi opposed Tsuji's efforts at killing the Americans in the Philippines and the Philippine government officials. Literally the night before the battle, he gets Kawaguchi sacked. So the Japanese attack on 2 wings, and sure enough, the wing whose commander had just been replaced, Kawaguchi's, it misses the Americans entirely in the dark, in the jungle. It goes like on a tangent to the American position, just goes off into the jungle. No one really knows what happened to it. But the Japanese army, they report, they send out a radio signal, Banzai! The airfield was taken! And so the Japanese start sending planes to land at the newly captured airfield. And for some reason, these planes keep disappearing. And they could not confirm that the airfield was in Japanese hands. It was about 6 hours later.
Sorry, we didn't actually capture the airfield.
What do you mean you didn't capture the airfield?
Well, we thought we did. Our troops entered a field and thought it was the airfield, but it wasn't.
It was the Japanese reported capture of Henderson Field that prompted Yamamoto to go to war or go to attack the American carriers, because he did not have that American air base staring him in the flank now. Well, it was, but they couldn't really do anything because the range was too great and they were still recovering from the attack. Santa Cruz, we lost a carrier. We lost a destroyer. The Japanese lost nothing in terms of ships. from that sense, that was it was an American defeat. The Japanese still held the field. They literally chased us from it. That was a tactical defeat. Strategically, there have been some claims that it was a Japanese victory, but I think it would be a draw. And the reason is their flight crew losses were so heavy and their effectiveness had been so reduced as evinced by the final attacks on the USS Hornet that didn't really do much aside from one lucky torpedo hit, that maybe they couldn't do anything with that air power. You have the only two operational carriers in the Pacific at that point, the Zuikaku and the Junyo. But just because they're operational doesn't mean they can do anything. If their pilots are incompetent, they can't do anything. Could the pilots have handled the Americans at Henderson Field? I think that's an open question. I don't know if they could. The Americans at Henderson Field, they were being starting to be rotated out by that point because they had been run pretty ragged over the previous 2 months. They were starting to make mistakes. They were worn out. They needed replacement and they needed a break because you can only take that kind of pressure for so long. And this was the thing the Japanese never noticed. Every time they sank a carrier, the American airfield got stronger. They got a new batch of airplanes. How are the Americans able to do that? Well, you keep sinking our carriers. We got to send the plane somewhere. Might as well send to Henderson Field. And so they would sink a carrier, but Henderson Field would get stronger, and they would be less able to reinforce the army on Guadalcanal in order to take Henderson Field. It was a very intractable problem for the Japanese, and they never quite put two and two together. But after the Saratoga was torpedoed, some of her planes were sent to Henderson Field. The Enterprise was knocked out for a bit. Her planes were sent to Henderson Field. The Wasp was sunk. Her planes were sent to Henderson Field. With the Enterprise, she was still kind of sort of operational. She had all the pilots of the Hornet and the Enterprise on board who hadn't been killed in Santa Cruz. I mean, the Japanese chased the Americans from the field. The Americans just sent the planes to Guadalcanal for the most part. It does not seem to me that the Japanese carriers that were available, the Zuikaku and the Junyo, with the air crews that were available, with the pilots that were available, the aviators, whether they could have taken anything in the way of offensive action after that is very questionable. They were so ineffective against the stationary Hornet. The crews on Guadalcanal were so experienced. They were used to the fighting. And later on, the Junyo didn't really do much. The Japanese had so little confidence in their air crews, they sent the Zuikaku back to Japan to train a new air group. So everyone was put on the Junyo at that point. But the Junyo didn't do much. So the Japanese themselves, they felt that they couldn't do much with their carriers after that.
Jeff, that seems like a natural ending point, so let's leave it there. Thanks. I can really recommend Jeff's book. It's a good read and he has a great turn of phrase. The book is Morning Star, Midnight Sun, The Early Guadalcanal Solomons Campaign of World War II, August to October 1942, by Geoffrey Cox. So when I return next time, I believe we'll be still in the Pacific, looking at the remarkable story of Lieutenant Colonel Dias, whose story curiously crosses paths with Barton Mott from episode 45 of the podcast. Until then, thanks for listening.